Welcome, everybody. This is the second lecture of the class Money, Monopoly, and Market Intervention, which is our tour of the third installment of Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. So today we are going over the rest of Chapter 10, basically focusing on monopoly theory. So here's the outline for tonight's lecture, although it's misleading. This section 1 here has got A's definition, then there's a B, C, D, E, and it goes on for some time, and I didn't bother typing it all in because I would have run out of room. So there's a lot of material for tonight, so why don't we jump right in. So the first main section is Rothbard talks about the illusion of monopoly price, but before he does that, he first says, you know, before we talk about monopoly price, we need to know what do we mean by monopoly or monopolist. So he runs through some possible definitions of that. Now, it's a little bit misleading because he actually only labels, or I should say numbers, 3 of them. So he says there's definition 1, definition 2, and 3. But before he talks about definition 1, he does refer to what I think is a definition that's floating out there. And he says that a monopolist, it's sometimes asserted that monopolist is somebody who can control its price. So here, but like I say, Rothbard deals with that definition, I would call it, but he doesn't label that as a definition. You know, he then, a few paragraphs later, labels as definition 1, a monopolist is the only seller of a given good. All right, so just make sure you understand that, and that's why I'm handling it like this on the slide. All right, so for that first pseudo-definition, if you will, to say, okay, well, when we talk about a monopolist in economics, we mean somebody who can control the price of his good. I'll keep coming back to this and trying to reinforce the idea. You have to understand, in mainstream economics, just about everything having to deal with competitive markets and what's called the welfare implications of market structure. And by welfare there, I don't mean welfare like handing out checks to poor people. I mean welfare like, is something good or bad for society as a whole? Does it improve social welfare? That's what I mean when I talk about welfare implications. The mainstream, when they deal with analysis of monopoly as opposed to what they call a perfectly competitive market or monopolistic competition, then I could see some people in the chat box here having trouble, so let me just type in one thing. Oops. How do I do this? Okay. Okay, because I'm not sure if we had a TA logged in to help those guys yet. Okay, so when the monopolist or when mainstream economists, when they want to use welfare analysis to see is monopoly good or bad in the grand scheme of things, they want to be neutral about it, right? And so last lecture I went through very quickly at the end a mainstream neoclassical diagram and tried to show you guys graphically how a mainstream economist would sort of objectively argue that monopoly is bad for society. Okay, so it's not, they do have a method of doing that besides just taking the side of the consumer, because in mainstream monopoly analysis, what happens is you've got the competitive output and price, and there the idea is firms are competitive in the mainstream sense of that term when they view themselves as unable to influence the market price. So they're called price takers. And then in contrast, a monopolist sets the price. So that's the thing that Rothbard tackles first of all in this first slide. And we're going to come back to that later on in tonight's lecture, because that there's Rothbard just does some great stuff with that mainstream analysis. Okay, but in case you've never studied formal economics, or even if you had but your teacher didn't really emphasize it, that's why I keep hitting this, is because I want you to see for the mainstream this is really where just about all the action is. Is this distinction between a price taker versus, you could say, a price maker if you wanted to have something that rhymes, but usually they'll just say a monopolist What they'll say is a monopolist has market power, whereas a perfectly competitive firm does not have market power. So the crucial distinction, again, is that the idea is in a competitive market, an individual firm is so small that contributes such a small portion of the total output that whether that firm shuts down or whether that firm doubles output, the market price isn't going to budge. That's the idea. So it's like if you were an individual wheat farmer, you're just, you know, Farmer Joe, and you've got your little farm, and you're growing wheat, and you're selling your output in the world market, it doesn't matter how much you planted. It doesn't matter whether you had a good yield or harvest or not. It doesn't matter if your teenage son screwed up and dumped half of your yield into the river. The market price you're just going to take is a given. It is whatever it is, and you sell all you can at the market price, and you optimize your own operations, taking that market price of wheat as some given external fact to which you adjust. In contrast, if you're Bill Gates and you're trying to decide how many units of the next version of our operating system do we want to produce and sell in the year 2013, you're not just going to say, well, shoot, what's the market price going to be for our operating system that year? And then, given that that's the market price, how many units do we want to make to maximize our profit? That's not the way they would think. They would realize, well, the market price is going to depend on how much we want to sell, all right, that we face a downward sloping demand curve. That's the idea. So Rothbard tackles that head on, and he says, no, it's not true that a monopolist can control the price he charges or set his price, whereas a competitive firm or the owner of a competitive firm has to accept this external price. He says in an important sense in terms of property rights and individual self-sovereignty, a so-called monopolist doesn't have any more or less power in an important respect than the owner of a competitive firm. And again, I'm going to stop putting quotation marks around or inflecting my voice, but obviously throughout this lecture, if I casually refer to a competitive firm in contrast to a monopolistic firm, obviously I mean in the sense that a mainstream economist means it, because the whole point here is Rothbard's going to say there is no such distinction. That's a spurious distinction, at least on the free market. Okay? So, again, I'm going to stop caveating it and always correcting myself. Just keep that in mind as we go forward. When I use those terms, those are mainstream terms, not Rothbardian ones. That's the whole point here, is he's trying to say that it makes no sense to distinguish a so-called monopolistic price or monopolist from a competitive actor if we're talking about a laissez-faire economy. Okay, so Rothbard says, though, even on its own terms, wait a minute, Farmer Joe, who's selling wheat, nobody compels him to sell wheat at whatever the world price is, so many dollars per bushel. I have no idea what wheat sells for. So those of you who know agricultural markets, I'm going to embarrass myself. Let's just say it's $10 a bushel. It's probably less than that. I have no idea. But let's just say it's $10 a bushel is the world price for wheat. And so mainstream analysts will just loosely talk as if Farmer Joe can sell as much wheat as he wants at the market price of $10 per bushel. But Rothbard's point is, well, yes, but it's not that Farmer Joe is forced to sell it at $10. Obviously, if he wants to sell it at $9, he can do that. He can sell as much as he wants at $9. People will be lining up outside his door if he's selling for less than the market price. All right, so he can certainly sell for less if he wants to. Nobody's stopping him. And he can try to charge more. If he slaps a price of $11 per bushel on his wheat, that's not against the law. Nobody's stopping him. Of course, no one's going to buy it from him. If everybody else is selling at 10, no one's going to buy his wheat at 11. So really, Rothbard says, what we mean when we say Farmer Joe has to sell his wheat at 10 really all we ended, you know, he takes the prices given. It's sort of dictated to him. All it really means is he faces a very elastic demand curve, and that in his own interest, he would be stupid to sell for less than 10, so he's not going to do that. He could if he wanted to, but he chooses not to, so that's not imposed on him. That's something he does himself. And then if he tries to sell it at 11, his sales, you know, his quantity sold drops to zero, or the quantity demanded drops to zero. So that's, and Robert's point is, that is the same qualitative situation that the monopolist faces. That, you know, he can charge whatever price he wants, in the sense of slapping on a price and saying, I'm only going to sell at this price, and then he faces a demand curve. So anyway, a mainstream economist, I think, who read this part in Rofford's book would sort of roll his eyes and say, well, okay, sure, but that's really all we're saying, that the perfectly competitive firm faces basically a perfectly horizontal demand curve for all intents and purposes, whereas a monopolist quite explicitly recognizes that he faces the market demand curve, which is downward sloping. So that's another way of explaining the distinction in mainstream terms, in case you haven't seen it. For every market, the ultimate market demand curve is downward sloping. So even if we're talking about the market for wheat, the global market for wheat, the market demand is downward sloping, right? The more expensive wheat is, the fewer bushels people around the world collectively want to buy. The cheaper wheat is, the more bushels people in the aggregate around the world want to buy. So the market demand curve for wheat is downward sloping. But the point is, each individual wheat producer is such a dinky little speck of the overall quantity that from the individual's point of view, it's as if the demand for wheat, for his particular wheat, is perfectly elastic. That at the going market price, he can sell zero, or he can sell 2,000 bushels, or anywhere in between. But if he tries to charge one penny more, his sales drop to zero. That's the idea. So if the individual wheat farmer were to experiment with pricing his own product and plot out a demand curve, he would just end up plotting a horizontal line at the world price of wheat. And he would see that, you know, so it's not that if he charged more, he would sell a little bit less. It's that if he charged one penny more, boom, his sales would instantly go from whatever it was the day before to zero. That's the idea. And also, if he charged, is this true? Yeah, and it's also true, there's no gain to him from charging less. It's not that, oh, if I charge, say the world price is 10, the individual wheat farmer, if he really thought he faced a perfectly horizontal demand curve, perfectly elastic, it's not even that he could say, oh, well, at $10 a bushel, I can sell 1,000, and if I want to sell 1,100 bushels, then I got to lower my price to $9.90. No, he doesn't think like that, because that would mean a downward sloping demand curve, and a perfectly competitive price-taking producer thinks he faces a perfectly horizontal demand curve. So he wouldn't think that. He would say, no, whatever quantity people buy from me, well, that's the thing. It's that it's a horizontal line. So it's not that when he charges $10, what's the quantity demanded by his customers, it's that they would be willing to absorb any amount he could produce, right? So it's kind of weird. It's not, you know, a normal demand curve that's downward sloping for any given price. You just move out to the right until you hit the demand curve, which is, you know, a line going down. And then once you hit it, oh, that's the quantity. But in, this is kind of an important point. This is perhaps a big detour, but let me just make sure you guys are getting this. How do I do this? So if I click on whiteboard, hopefully it's going to screw up everything. I'm not going to take real long on this, but let me just make sure you guys get this. And don't worry, this isn't going to be very technical, but okay, so here's price, and here's quantity. You can see that after economics, art was my calling. Okay, so a normal demand curve is downward sloping and it looks like this. So what does that mean? It means you can give, you know, name any price, like this price right here, let's say that's $9.95, and I say, what's the quantity demand? And you go up, and you go out, and then you hit it, and you come down, and you hit it right there, and that's the quantity. All right, but instead of that, how do I get rid of this? What is this? Is the eraser? Okay. Instead of that, what if instead my demand curve looks like this? And that's supposed to be a perfectly horizontal line, even though it's a little bit wobbly. If it looks like that, what does that mean? That's saying at this market price right here, where that intersects the vertical axis, the quantity demanded is not really defined. It's the whole line. So it's zero is on the line, one unit's on the line, two units are on the line, all the way up to here, whatever that is, 10,000 units. So the idea is a perfectly competitive firm that thinks its own demand curve is this horizontal line, they believe, I mean, what does that mean economically? It means they think I could sell zero units or I could sell, you know, as many as I'm physically capable of producing, and I can sell that, you know, anywhere in that range, in that spectrum, at the market price that I observe around me that everybody else is getting. That's what it means. Okay, so anyway, Rothbard is saying that really, you know, in terms of what you what property rights you have in that in the grand scheme of things, there is no difference. That the monopolist and the competitive firm both have the same power, if you will, or market power, in the sense that they can do whatever they want and they're subject to the buying decisions of their customers, right? But a mainstream economist, again, is going to come back and say, okay, fine, all we really mean is the perfectly competitive firm faces a very elastic demand curve that for all intents and purposes we can say is a horizontal line, and then that has serious implications for the welfare properties of markets in terms of do they do a good job of allocating resources and all that kind of stuff, right? So let me just tell you this, in case you don't know. Mainstream formal neoclassical analysis, all the cost curves and all that stuff, it's true that it's used to spit out all sorts of things that are called market failures. And they generate all sorts of arguments to justify government intervention. But ironically, they have to work really hard to do that. That prima facie, the standard benchmark models that they use, markets are extraordinarily efficient. And so it's actually funny that in mainstream economics, what happened in the 20th century, especially the second half, is that you had all these really smart people sitting around trying to think up, you know, we got to dream up ways in which the market economy doesn't do a good job, because on the surface, it's awesome. And so the perfectly competitive market, everything's beautiful, that you in principle you can't improve upon it. And then so that's why it's important, you know, so that's the idea that they try to, the mainstream economists will say, if everybody were a price taker, we'd have nirvana, or not nirvana, but we'd have the best that humans could be capable of. But then if firms believe their demand curve is downward sloping, then the trouble creeps in. So we'll see that later on, like why with their graphs, downward sloping demand curves are bad. Okay, let's move on because we got tons of material. So what about the definition that says a monopolist is the only seller of a given good? Well, Rothbard says, okay, that's the literal meaning of the term. If you look at the roots, you know, if you, I guess, was it Greek or the Greek roots, that's, you know, that's a perfectly plausible definition. There's no objection, except it's too broad. Then if you take that, then everything is a monopoly. That, you know, there's a single seller of Murray Rothbard's economic services. There's a single seller of Farmer Joe's wheat. There's a single seller of, you know, whatever. Anything you want to think of. And so depending on how specific you define what the good or the service is, you can restrict it such that there's only one seller of it, and then up, the world is full of monopolists. So even though that definition is internally consistent, it's not really very useful. Then Rothbard says, okay, another definition would be a grant of special privilege by the state, reserving a certain area of production to a group or individual. So of course, as you can imagine, Rothbard's very sympathetic to this definition, and he says that historically, this is probably why monopoly has such a bad connotation, that there's good reason for that, that historically, when people first started talking about monopolies and analyzing them, what they meant was that the king, for example, would say, in my kingdom, only one group is allowed to do whatever, like issue banknotes. And so that, you know, that's obviously a monopoly privilege. It was granted to the central bank. So private commercial banks before used to be able to issue their own competing notes. And then the king comes in and says, no, you can't do that. From now on, only the Bank of England is allowed to issue paper banknotes in this country. And if we catch anybody else doing that, you get in trouble. And so in the medieval period, kings would do that a lot, would give more, you know, regional monopolies to privileged people. I think the way it would work is somebody would pay the king a bunch of money, and then the king would declare, okay, this person is now the only legal one to be able to do this particular activity in this area. A more modern example might be something like driving a taxi cab in New York City, that you have to get a special medallion issued by the city government for which you have to pay, I think, something like $300,000 or more. I don't know what the latest number is, but it's an astoundingly high amount of money because the city only issues a limited number of these medallions, and they say if we catch, you know, if the police see any cabbies driving around that don't have these medallions, you get in trouble. And so it's a monopoly privilege given to a select group, or the delivery of first-class mail is a monopoly that the post office enjoys. All right, so that's another example. So Rothbard says it's useful to study mainstream monopoly theory in its analysis of the impact, the welfare implications of monopoly price as contrasted with a competitive price, because we can actually use it here, that it does make sense to speak of a monopoly price versus a competitive one, if by monopoly we mean a privilege that's granted by the state that then uses force to prevent competition. Finally, Robert, there's another definition we could talk about, is that a monopolist is somebody who is able to achieve a monopoly price. And ultimately, the problem with that definition is going to be that Rothbard thinks there's really no such thing as monopoly price, again, unless we're talking about it's something due to a state intervention. Okay, at this point, Rothbard talks very quickly about, you know, so he brings up this issue of state privilege, and then he says, is a trademark then a government monopoly? And we're going to, assuming we don't run out of time in tonight's lecture, we're going to come back to this at the end of the lecture to talk about patents and copyrights. But for right now, in this part of the chapter, Rothbard says that no, that's not what we mean. He says when we talk about an illegitimate, dastardly king or other government official granting a monopoly to somebody, we mean that they're interfering with property rights, that they're basically, what they're really doing is interfering with everybody else's ability to be able to do the same activity. So if the king says the only people who can print newspapers in this city are the Jones family, and by the way, behind the scenes, the Jones family gave the king a bunch of money for that, well, that's a violation of property rights in Rothbard's view, because really what that means is the king says, if I catch anybody else using their printing press and using paper that they have acquired legitimately to crank out newspapers, then we're going to send guys with long lances on horseback to put you in a dungeon. So that's a violation of property rights. In contrast, Rothbard says that trademark, at least in principle, is nothing like that. That when you, to have the government enforce a trademark, I mean, besides the fact that it's the government existing, that by itself is really just the maintenance of property rights. It's really protecting consumers from fraud. Because to say, oh, I'm protecting my trademark, what does that really mean? It means that if I catch somebody else, you know, so if the owners of Microsoft catch some other computer vendor putting on the Microsoft logo on their products, and then Microsoft, you know, sues that company or whatever, what all they're really doing is trying to stop that company from fraudulently taking advantage of their own customers, because the idea behind this is that, you know, the trademark logos are so distinctive that couldn't be an accident. If you put that Coca-Cola symbol on your soda product that looks, you know, that's in a can that's red and that has that thing on it, and people open it up and there's black soda inside, they're going to assume that that's the Coca-Cola. So you're effectively lying to them if it's not. You're defrauding them. And so that's the angle Rothbard takes. So with all this stuff, and I'm sure maybe many of you will have questions about that, maybe that's already posted or that you have in the that you'll post later on. You know, we can get into Stephen Kinsella's, I guess you could call it advancement or retrogression if you don't like it. Stephen Kinsella has definitely altered the way many, perhaps most modern Rothbardians think about this stuff. All right, but in this class, what I'm doing is just walking you through Rothbard's thought as of the writing of Man, Economy, and State. So that's what he's saying here at this point. But like I say, I think Stephen Kinsella has really altered our opinion on a lot of this stuff. Okay, let me review something that I talked about last week, but it's kind of a subtle point, so let me go ahead and go over it again. So Rothbard and Mises make a lot of the need, how can I put it? They basically are qualifying Mises' own views as to when we have to worry about a monopoly price. So Mises says it's not enough that there's a single seller of a good. In order for us to worry about there being a monopoly price and hence a violation of consumer sovereignty, Mises says you need an additional condition. It has to be the case that at the competitive level of output and price, the demand curve just so happens to be inelastic. Then and only then would the monopolist have an incentive to restrict output and raise prices. Okay, so another way of putting that is for Mises to say, assume you're originally at the competitive level of output and prices or price, and then a monopolist, you know, all the firms merge together into one giant firm that's a monopoly. If the market demand curve is such that at that previous level it happened to be in an elastic portion of the demand curve, then the monopolist is going to mimic the behavior of the competitive firms. All right. I don't know that Mises ever actually said that the way I just did, but that's kind of the implication of his view. And so now I'm here to tell you a mainstream economist would not endorse that. So I don't know if the problem is that Mises was just wrong and misunderstood mainstream or economics, because Mises was adopting it himself back in Human Action, or maybe it's that mainstream theory has evolved in the decades since so that what I learned when I was going through school was not the same thing that Mises was saying and that Rothbard picked up and stated as neoclassical monopoly theory. Okay, but again, let me just say it again in summary. Just be careful. Mainstream neoclassical economists would not agree with Mises and Rothbard when they say that if the competitive price falls on an elastic portion of the market demand curve, then the monopolist wouldn't restrict output. The mainstream economists would disagree, and they would say, yes, he would. So I tried to give you a little bit of the intuition there. What's going on is the way that Mises and then Rothbard following him try to motivate and get you to see why a monopolist would restrict output if the demand curve is inelastic is they're going to say, well, you know, what does that mean if the demand curve is inelastic in that region? It means that if you – make sure I say this right. If you rate, if you change prices, then quantity responds by a lower percentage. So if you're at an inelastic portion of the demand curve, the way I remember it is just think of elasticity as like how flexible is the quantity. So if you're in an inelastic portion of the demand curve, it means when you raise prices a lot, the quantity demanded just moves a little bit. It's not very elastic, it's inelastic. Okay, so what does that mean? It means that, oh, so if you raise prices by 10%, then quantity demanded maybe only falls 5%. So that means you bring in more total revenue, right? Because total revenue is price times quantity. So if you raise prices 10%, your sales are going to fall, right? Because the market demand curve is downward sloping. But if your sales fall by less than how much you raised prices, then your P times Q ends up being bigger. That's the idea. So Mises and Rothbard are totally right. It's blaringly obvious that if you're a monopolist all of a sudden and you're looking at the original P and Q and you realize, whoa, I could sell fewer units raise the price more than proportionately so that my total revenues are higher than they were before, well, that's a no-brainer. You don't need to tell me anymore. I'm doing that. But now what's more subtle is, and this is what a mainstream economist would say, even if my total revenues go down, I still, on the margin, am going to cut output at least a little bit. And that's because what I really care about is not maximizing total revenue, but maximizing my profit, which is total revenue minus total cost. So just to repeat all that again, Mises and Rothbard have shown if you're originally in an inelastic portion of the demand curve, you can make your total revenues go up by reducing output. So since reducing output is also going to lower your costs, well, duh, you're going to have more revenue and lower costs. Of course you're going to do it. But they seem to think that's the only case in which you would do it, and they're wrong, if that's what they think. Because by lowering output, even when the demand curve was elastic, yeah, your total revenue can go down, but at least there's a possibly a very small margin there where your total costs go down more than your total revenue does, so that the difference between the two goes up a little bit, which is profit. All right, so And really, you might think that that's just a possibility, and how do you know? Well, you know if you reason in terms of margins, marginal revenue and marginal cost, that originally, if all the firms, the competitive firms, pushed output to the point at which marginal revenue equaled marginal cost, and them being price takers thought that marginal revenue was the market price, and now all of a sudden the monopolist realizes, oh, wait a minute, if I cut output, then the market price goes up. Well, then that changes the perception of what the marginal revenue really is. And so that's why on the margin, when you switch from being a price taker to being a monopolist that perceives your individual demand curve as the whole market demand curve, it changes your perspective. And now you're in a position where marginal revenue is lower than your marginal cost, and so you make more total profit by cutting back output. So that's the idea. So I certainly have not proven that to you, I'm just asserting it, but to the extent that you think I probably know standard mainstream price theory, just take my word for it, under standard assumptions, it doesn't matter where you are on the demand curve, the marginal analysis is such that a monopolist would always restrict output at least a little bit. And so lower output and raise prices relative to the so-called competitive outcome. Okay. Roper talks about monopoly profit versus monopoly gain. This is actually a pretty good point. I'm glad he emphasized it. So here, what he's complaining about is that a lot of people refer to the monopolist as if he can just indefinitely reap a monopoly profit. And Rothbard says, no, that's not true. That even if it made, you know, let's concede for the sake of argument that it makes sense to contract the monopoly with a competitive price, and that we're saying, oh, we've got a situation where the monopolist is a bad guy and he restricted output, raised prices, and so now he's earning an above normal rate of return initially. Rothbard's point is that it's wrong to analyze that situation and say that, oh, the market interest rate is 5%, but that dastardly monopolist, you know, who took over the diamond industry because, you know, he's in the De Beer family and they happen to own all the diamond mines and they restrict output and now prices went up and now they're earning 10% per year on their capital indefinitely. Robert said, no, that's wrong. That's not what's going on there. What would happen is the De Beer family would impute the future revenues, or future profits, I guess I should, or sorry, not profits, future income stream from owning that monopolized resource, in this example, the diamond mines in South Africa, to that asset, right? So the capitalized market price of those diamond mines now would go up more. All right, so let me start again and say, let's say initially all the diamond mines in South Africa were owned by 100 different individuals, and they each, you know, perceived a demand curve for diamonds that was pretty elastic, and you had a so-called competitive level of diamond production and market price for diamonds. Then the De Beers family comes in, and they buy out the 99 other rivals, and now they own the whole thing, and they perceive their demand curve as being the global market demand curve for diamonds, so they restrict diamond output, raise the unit price of diamonds, and now they just start, you know, reaping a larger annual flow of income. The point is, they could now, if they wanted, sell off that big clump of diamond mines to somebody else for a lot more than they had to pay to each of the 99 people when they first bought in. So, yes, they earned a one-time capital gain when, you know, the income stream went from the little trickles to all the 100 people to the huge flow to the giant monopolist. But after that one-shot adjustment, now the rate of return, you know, of their income flow to their market value is the going rate of interest, because that income stream would get imputed into the present value of the diamond mines. So that's what Rothbard's getting at. I don't know if I made that easier or harder by going through that example, but that's what he's getting at. Because again, the point here is, and the reason this is something that an Austrian would stress, is profits are a fleeting thing. Profits have to do with people anticipating the future and evaluating the market price of resources now based on the income they're going to generate in the future. Whereas when we talk about monopolies, we're talking about differences in income. That if you are a monopolist, maybe you can derive a higher income from a certain group of factors than if they were dispersed competitively, but you're not talking about profit or not. That once we know what the income is, then boom, that gets capitalized back into the market price of those resources. Okay, Rothbard talks about this idea of cutthroat competition. And so here, the worry is that what if some firm sells below cost, knocks out all of his rivals, and then once he's a monopolist, he jacks up the price. That, you know, don't we have to worry about stuff like that? And so that's why some people think there should be regulations in place to make it illegal for firms to sell below cost. And for sure, people want to have tariffs or other trade barriers in place to protect us from what's called dumping, that they don't want, you know, the worry is that these foreign companies, perhaps backed up with subsidies from their own governments, are going to come into our market and dump a bunch of goodies on us that our stupid consumers flock to because they're so cheap. But if our consumers could just open up their eyes and realize, wait a minute, these firm, you know, that Japanese firm can't possibly be staying in business, be turning a profit by selling a TV for as cheap as they're selling it. It's because they're getting subsidized by their government, and really what they're trying to do is just knock out all of the U.S. TV manufacturers, and then once they go down, then the Japanese firm is going to, you know, completely dominate the market, and then they're going to jack up the price when we have no one else to buy from. So we need the U.S. government to look into this situation and to look at the books and to demand that the Japanese firm prove that it's not selling below cost, or else we're going to have tariffs or whatever. All right, so that's the kind of thing here that happens in modern political discourse. And so Rothbard picks apart all those various the various angles of that argument. So I'll just touch on a few points. So one thing is, from a property rights perspective, of course, look, nobody's forcing anybody to do anything. If a firm comes in and wants to sell at a price below cost, okay, you know, that, why should we be stopping? You know, that they're actually, that's good for consumers, right? Another thing is, Rothbard says, this, the whole notion of selling below cost is a misnomer, because once the stock of goods is made, there's virtually no cost to selling it, right? Really, the opportunity cost is just, you know, there's a speculative point, like if you think you could hold on to it and get a higher price in the future, and maybe there's a little bit of a reservation demand for personal use. But if you're a Japanese firm and you made 100,000 TV sets that you're now sitting on, that they're sitting in your warehouse, the cost to you of selling them is pretty low. You know, because even you might say, well, what about the shipping costs? Well, if your alternative is to have somebody from the dump come and get them and put them in a landfill, well, you got to pay those guys too to ship it. And so, you know, really it's once the product is produced and sitting in your warehouse, the actual correctly calculated cost to you of selling it is pretty low, because there's really not many alternatives left to you. So, of course, what people mean by that is to say, are you selling at a price such that it would be worthwhile for you to keep doing this over and over? And there, there's a couple more points. Rothbard says, well, for one thing, let's assume the worst-case scenario. Let's assume that the Japanese firm does do that. It comes in, dumps the TVs on the U.S. market, puts everybody else out of business, and then jacks up the prices. Well, then at that point, why wouldn't the U.S. firms come back into the market? And so the Japanese firm then would be silly to behave like that, because they would be suffering losses up front in order just for a temporary period when they could charge very high prices. But then eventually, you know, that period couldn't last forever. At some point, it would make sense for somebody to come in and charge a little bit less than the really outrageously high prices. So there's that issue. Another thing is, well, another point is just historically, I don't think there's any example of that happening. There's certainly, I'm almost positive there's no example of a free market company doing that. I mean, you do have cases where companies are getting subsidized by their own governments, and then they sell abroad at, you know, below cost in the popular parlance. But that's certainly, I mean, we can talk about, is it the business of our government to make up for other interventions, but certainly that's not a free market outcome. What else? Okay. Oh, another point is that there are, I wish I could remember, there was a funny historical example of this. I think it was like a titan of industry, like, I don't know that it was this name, but it was somebody like Vanderbilt or Carnegie or you know, Rockefeller. It was one of those guys, I think, that early in the career, some rival did try to do that, like to knock him out of business by selling something way below cost. And what that person did is they just started, so they stopped producing, right? Because they weren't going to be wasting money matching the price, you know. So in other words, I'm making up numbers, but let's say it's something like I don't know, like crude oil. Okay, let's just say that, you know, initially you've got this humongous, like, let's say it's Saudi Arabia wants to knock some people out of business, you know, some little wildcat oil men in Texas. And so the world price is originally $100 a barrel. And then so Saudi Arabia comes in and they just start selling it at, no, that's not a good example because Saudi Arabia's production costs are a lot lower. All right, forget the oil. Something else, some generic commodity that it costs everybody $10 to make it, and the company comes in and starts selling it at $9. And this company originally had like 80% of the market, and it starts selling at $9, trying to knock out the other 20% of the market so that it can have a total monopoly. Right, that's the idea. So, first of all, notice that if all the competitors just match the behavior, that big firm is losing more money from the policy because they control 80% of the market. So they're suffering, you know, they're absorbing 80% of those losses. And then the other thing is, depending on the commodity, you know, it's possible that the firms, the little guys that are, you know, they don't have to match the price. They can just shut down temporarily. So rather than be selling at $9 when it costs you $10 per unit, so instead of losing a dollar for every unit you're making, you could just cut your losses by shutting down temporarily and not be losing money for every unit you're producing. You'd still have your overhead and all that kind of stuff, but if the point is that the big guy is selling at such a low price that you can't even cover your what's called variable costs, well, then you make, you know, you limit your losses just by shutting down temporarily. So they could do that. Another thing, and like I said, there is at least one historical case of this happening, is the little guy could start stockpiling the stuff produced by the big guy. So if the big guy is selling something that, you know, normally would cost 11, and it costs 10 to produce, or, you know, the price would normally be 11, and in terms of money expenditures, it costs you $10 to produce it, and the big firm comes in and starts cranking it out at 9, not only would the little guys stop selling, they would start stockpiling it and buying up units at 9. So that does two things. It puts more pressure on the big firm because now they're having to sell more units at a price at which they're losing money. And if they ever capitulate and let the price go back, now that those little firms can start selling it at 11 for products that they purchased at 9 instead of producing it themselves at 10. All right, so it's like a double whammy. Okay? So that's so that's the just various things. Now, if you if you go into mainstream economics and you get into this stuff, it's interesting to model these things in terms of strategic game theory. So like I say, there has been like actual historical research to go back and look at like the Rockefellers and stuff like that to see, do we have actual examples of this cutthroat competition working where somebody came in and charged a low price, knocked everybody else out, and then jacked up the price. And that's not really, that's not, like I said, there's no well-documented historical case of that happening. Now, what you do see is stuff like Standard Oil coming in and lowering the price of kerosene and gaining market share, but they didn't jack up the price later on. The point is just they came in, they were more efficient, and so they could afford to charge a lower price, and that put a lot of people out of business. But they weren't doing it strategically. They were just efficient. But anyway, my game theory professor one time went through that example, and he pointed out that there is a little bit of a hitch in the argument that, so yeah, it's true. So the way the free market argument normally goes, and the way Rothbard did it in Man, Economy, and State, is to say it would be dumb for a big firm to try to undercut its rivals and then put them out of business and then jack up prices, because then new firms would come into the market. And so it would look ahead and realize, oh, this isn't going to work. And so it would never try to undercut in the first place. But this guy pointed out, he said, well, wait a minute. If the big firm had enough money to blow, and it the first few times new entrants tried to come in and sell, you know, at a little bit less than the monopoly price, if the big monopolist undercut them too and knocked them out of business, if the firm just looked tough and it did that the first few rounds every time somebody came in, eventually everybody would realize there's no point in me challenging the big firm, because I'm going to go under. That, you know, they have more money to waste than I do, and so it's pointless. So, if you know, depending on the numbers and the strategic considerations and how you're modeling it, you might be able to come up with a sustainable equilibrium where the big firm can undercut, knock people out of business, and then charge a permanently higher than the competitive price, because the rivals know that there's no point in them entering because they're just going to get knocked out. So that's, anyway. So it was mentioning that came up when I was in grad school. But again, that's all theoretical stuff in terms of, can we prove it wouldn't make sense for a monopolist to try to do that? You can prove just about any, or you can demonstrate just about anything you want with formal mathematical models, but I think it is true that historically we don't have any well-documented cases ever of somebody, certainly in a free market, doing that. Okay, so coming back now to what the the name of this whole section, the illusion of monopoly price. So Rothbard now finally comes back and makes the point. It's pretty simple, really. He's saying, look, thus far I've been taking the theory on its own terms and going through the various implications and pointing out shortcomings and internal inconsistencies, blah, blah, blah. But look, let me now just state quite plainly, the whole notion of monopoly price, at least as it might exist on a free market, is an illusion, because there's no... it's always defined by reference to a competitive price. But in the real world, even theoretically, how could we ever identify that? And so here I want to, well, let me just do the basic argument first, and then I'll talk about Rothbard's elaboration. So he's saying, okay, let's say there's a firm, and it's out there, and it's selling a product. Is it selling it at a monopoly price or a competitive price? How could we possibly know? what the, if you ask the firm, hey, what are you doing? And the guy answers truthfully, he's going to say, oh, well, I set the price, or sorry, I set the quantity at the level where I thought I would make the most total profit. And you could ask the owners of Nike that, and that's what they would tell you. You could go ask Farmer Joe, who sells wheat, what do you do? How do you run your business? And if he were so inclined and trained in terms of mathematical economics and so forth, he would say, I set my quantity to maximize the profit that I take home. So Robert's point is, whether you're a monopolistic firm or a competitive firm, in practice, they both do the same thing. And so it's there's no way in the real world to go look out at somebody and say that's a monopolist or that's a competitive firm. And then if we want to say, oh, well, it depends on whether they're price takers or not, well, you know, Robert has the two arguments. The one is to say, well, in a formal sense, they're all price makers in the sense that anybody can say this is the price I'm going to charge or not, and so and they're just subject to the demand curve. And then if you're going to push it and say, well, no, that's what we mean, that a monopolist is someone who faces a downward-sloping demand curve, whereas a competitive firm is one that faces a horizontal demand curve, well, then everybody's a monopolist, because in the real world, nobody faces literally a horizontal demand curve. It's not true that Farmer Joe could sell 10 trillion bushels of wheat at the market price. Eventually, he would have to charge a lower price to move that many more. And in fact, let me put you like this. Suppose Farmer Joe cuts back his output by one bushel. If he doesn't perceive that changing the price, well then from the monopolist's point of view, if the monopolist controlled the whole world's supply and he cut back output by one unit, then he shouldn't perceive a change either. Right? The consumers don't know whether they're being sold wheat from a monopolist or from a price taker. So if we're saying on the margin that Farmer Joe doesn't perceive a change in the world price when he alters output, well, then at least over a certain range, the monopolist shouldn't either, because whether he's cutting back 100 units or Farmer Joe is, it's still the case that the world market has to clear. All right, so that's just a few points. Oh, so then to come back to, I don't remember seeing this on the reading that I just did, so maybe Rothbard talks about it in a different part of the book, or maybe it's in Chapter 10 and I just missed it, but somewhere, Rothbard makes this point, and it certainly would be applicable here, that he points out and says, look, let me make sure you guys are understanding something. When I say we have no way of identifying in the real world what the alleged competitive price would be, I'm speaking about something that's more, I'm making a stronger statement than saying in the real world we could never identify what the pure rate of interest is compared to the risk component or the purchasing power component. All right, so remember, in the real world, we observe actual market rates of interest. That is not the pure originary rate of interest of the ERE. So in the real world, if a company wants to borrow money from me and I lend them $1,000 at 10%, we wouldn't say that my time preference is 10%. That I have time preference that's lower than that, and then on top of that, I'm also worried about the possibility of default. So when I'm charging these guys 10% interest, market interest, to lend them money, I'm worried about not only the fact that, no, now I have to wait before I can consume, but I'm also worried about the possibility that I'm never going to consume at all because they might go broke and not pay me back. And so I have to, part of that market contractual rate of interest is the risk component. And so if they're really risky, I'm probably going to charge them a higher market rate of interest than if they're a very safe firm. So clearly, that isn't about time preference. That's about the risk of default, or if you want to say the uncertainty, because it's not an insurable risk. So Rothbard, of course, doesn't say, oh, so there's the illusion of the pure rate of interest. There's the illusion of time preference, because in the real world, I can't look out and identify what the pure rate of interest is. Obviously, he doesn't believe that, because he talks about the pure rate of interest all the time. So Rothbard makes a distinction, and he says, you know, that's not what I mean when I say there's an illusion of monopoly price, that it's a stronger critique. I'm saying in principle, we can't even define what we mean by a competitive price, whereas I can at least define what I mean by the pure rate of interest, and we can talk about the fact that there's the market rate that's built up of various components. And sure, in practice, I can't tell you how big one component is or the other, but at least I can define for you what they are, and you know, we can talk about it theoretically. Whereas with the so-called competitive price, that's basically a meaningless phrase. What the heck are you talking about? So, you know, I think it's the easiest to talk about somebody who comes in and makes a new product from scratch that, got Steve Jobs comes and makes Apple products. What would it mean to contrast his behavior and the pricing of their, you know, MacBooks and whatever and iPods with the pricing behavior in a competitive industry where Apple is a price taker? You'd say, well, what do you mean? Like a world where there's 1,000 people that are just as talented as Steve Jobs? And are they all producing MacBooks, or are you saying they're each producing their own separate line that's kind of like Apple, but not quite Apple? You see what I'm saying? Like it gets hard to even define what are you talking about if you want to talk about what would a competitive price for Apple products look like, whereas we have a much better idea of what I mean if I talk about somebody's time preference. So that's what Rothbard's getting at there. Oh, another thing, too, is even if you might think, okay, sure, somebody who comes in out of nowhere and develops a new product and, in a sense, is the monopolist there, sure, that's – it'd be weird to talk about the competitive price. But what about if we had somebody – what if we had an original industry that had 30 players in it, and then through a bunch of mergers, one group just took over everybody else, cut output relative to what output historically was, and raise prices? Come on, isn't that a pretty clear-cut case of restricting output and raising price? Well, there you have to ask, how are they able to do that? That if it really is competitive, and you know, there's no government intervention going on, the only way a firm is going to be able to knock out its rivals or to take over, to gain market share, is if it's serving the customers better, whether it's because it's, you know, producing at lower costs, or whether it's just making the product better and so people pay the same but they like the product or whatever. And then even if you say, well, what if it's just a big collusion that they all just agree, you know, they realize that the market demand curve is inelastic, let's say, and they all say, guys, what are we doing? Let's just all agree to restrict output and raise prices, and we'll all be better off. Okay, but Rothbard earlier showed that a cartel is unstable. That even if the cartel members can all agree to do that, what's to stop some outsider from coming in and undercutting them? All right, so again, it's hard to even theoretically define what you mean by the competitive price against which you're contrasting the real-world price of somebody who's out there producing that you're going to call a monopolist. Okay. Um, Okay, right. So this is a graphical illustration of what I was have been hinting at all along in tonight's lecture. This is what mainstream economists mean by a perfectly competitive firm. So the idea is on the left side here, this is the market demand curve and the market supply curve. You know, let's say it's wheat. And then where they intersect here, oh, so that's the price, and then that's the quantity. So that's where the price gets determined in the world market. And then you take that world price and you come over here, and now this on the right side, this is the this is where you determine the output decision for an individual little dinky wheat farmer. So at this world determined market price, you just draw a straight line and say that's the demand curve that little farmer Joe perceives, and then farmer Joe has his marginal cost curve and his average cost curve, blah, blah, blah. So what does farmer Joe do? Well, he sets output where his marginal cost curve crosses the marginal revenue curve, which for farmer Joe happens to be the price line, because marginal revenue means if you sell one more unit, how much does your revenue go up? Well, since he can sell as much as he wants at the market price, the graph of marginal revenue is on top of the demand curve. They're the same thing. So he does that, he produces there, and for various reasons that we won't go into, that's the socially optimal level of output. Okay, so at this point, so anyway, Rothbard says, okay, well, what if, couldn't somebody say, oh, well, what we mean when we talk about the competitive level of output is the level that a perfectly competitive firm would produce. So Rothbard talks about that. He, you know, makes several points, things like this is fictitious. In the real world, there's no such thing as a perfectly horizontal demand curve. So, okay, you just now condemned everybody to being monopolist, if that's the definition you're going to use. And why don't I move on, because there's a couple other really good points I want to touch on, and we're getting low on time here. Okay, Rothbard switches gears, and he talks about unions, and he makes an important point here. He says, sometimes people try to use monopoly theory in reference to unions, and the idea is just like a monopolist might restrict output and raise prices, can't we imagine, you know, can't we model unions doing the same thing? That in a sense, they restrict output, the output of labor services, in order to raise wage rates. So, you know, couldn't we talk about labor unions as being monopoly suppliers of labor? And Rothbard says, no, actually, that's not right, because when you're a monopolist and you restrict output, you're the one who's not selling those units, right? If you originally were selling 1,000 and then you only sell 900, you, the monopolist, are forfeiting the opportunity of selling those last 100 units. So maybe it makes sense to do that, but the point is you're the one bearing the brunt of that opportunity cost. You could have sold those extra 100 units and you're choosing not to. In contrast, with a labor union, if they raise wage rates, then the people who stay employed get paid more, and then the unemployed people might not even be in the union. They might be somebody else. So if that's the case, then the union doesn't care at all. They have no problem raising wage rates higher and higher and throwing more and more people out of work. I don't think Rothbard gets into this at this part of the book. There is an issue where sometimes labor unions, like their members pay dues, and then they use, you know, they build up a fund to give unemployment benefits, as it were, to their own members if they lose their jobs. So there you could maybe talk about, you know, would it make sense, you know, for the union as a whole, if originally in an industry, if everybody's in the union and they restrict output, and then some people lose their jobs, and then the union just keeps paying them, those unemployed people, then, you know, that could be an issue. But beyond that, the reason Rockford isn't doing that is because he's saying, look, it's even if we're just looking at, well, I don't know how to put this. It's not enough just to look at the workers who happen to be in the industry. Let's say the whole industry is unionized and they're earning, you know, a certain above market wage rate and they're able to maintain that. He's saying the what's happening there is workers in other industries who aren't in the union would like to flow into that industry, but they're not. And so that's so even if it were true that everybody, all the workers in a given industry were unionized, it would be wrong to conclude that therefore there's nobody outside the union that's suffering because of their policies. That no, if the union really is holding wages above the market clearing rate, then there's unemployment by definition. So where are these unemployed workers? Well, they must be somewhere else. And remember, I should probably point this out in case you didn't realize it. You could have unemployment in a formal sense for a particular unionized sector, even if everybody in the economy has a job. Because really what would happen is there would be unemployment in that unionized sector, and then the displaced workers would flow to the non-unionized sectors, would push out the supply curve of labor and push down wage rates in them. But since those wage rates would be flexible, eventually all those markets would clear. So looking at the economy as a whole, you wouldn't find anybody who was without a job and wanted to work at prevailing wage rates. Rather, you would see somebody who was working at an inferior job, you know, making $10 an hour flipping burgers or something over here, when really that person would love to be a construction worker making $30 an hour, but he can't become a construction worker because construction's unionized and he can't get into the union. So in terms of drawing supply and demand curves for each sector, in the construction sector, there would be unemployment in the sense that there's plenty of workers who would love to supply their labor on that market at the going wage rate and yet can't get a job. But again, that doesn't mean they're sitting at home doing nothing. It could just mean they took a job elsewhere that wasn't unionized. Rothbard makes a good point. He says, could you have voluntary, how did you put it? I think he said something like, could a union exist and have above market wage rates even without using violence against strike breakers? And he says, yes, if enough people in the society for psychic reasons don't want to break the, don't want to cross the picket line. All right. So I don't know. Well, I think it's probably like this in most countries, but Robert says labor unions have done a very good job. This is certainly true in the U.S., and like I say, I think it's probably true in other industrialized countries. Labor unions have done a really good public relations job of making people feel bad for going and working for employers that are currently having a dispute with labor unions, right? So the workers want to get paid more. They go on strike. The employer says, okay, well, if you don't want to work for that, we'll go hire somebody else. That's in various certain social circles considered to be a really bad thing to do. Okay, so for example, in the U.S., the Writers Guild went on strike. So the people that write for TV shows, like, you know, shows like David Letterman and I think John Stewart's Daily Show, stuff like that, a couple of years ago. The writers all went on strike. And so there, you know, it was, how can I put it? So all the hosts of these shows were trying to be real polite and, you know, supporting the workers. And, you know, I love my writers and we got to support them. And this, so they would have been, anybody who went and started writing for David Letterman or something, you know, would have been viewed very badly among Hollywood celebrities. Like, they would have looked down on such a person. I mean, maybe people were doing it in secret, but the point is like that's considered very socially taboo, is to what's called cross the picket line. So as I'm telling you guys this, I'm not sure that I agree with Rothbard. I mean, we of course all get the point that he's making, but I'm not sure I agree with him. For, you know, looking back at this chart, I don't know that it really makes sense to say that there's unemployment, you know, there's involuntary unemployment if the reason you're not selling your labor is because you don't want to violate, you don't want to cross the picket line. So I'm not, maybe we'd have to go reread Rother. Maybe he's not saying that. Maybe he's just saying something slightly different. But anyway, just the important thing is unions, even if they don't use violence, can restrict output and raise prices if they could convince people that it was socially bad to challenge the unions. Okay, hang on, let me just see what other slides we got here. Let's pace ourselves. Okay. Let me spend a few moments on this because this is one of my favorite demonstrations in the whole book. Unfortunately, for you to appreciate this, you would have had to have studied at least undergraduate microeconomic price theory. But let me try to just at least walk you through this, because like I said, this is one of the top five things in the whole book in terms of just my favorite parts of it. Okay, so here, what Rothbard's taking on is the mainstream notion of what's called monopolistic competition, right? So you, to understand what's going on, originally you have a perfectly competitive market where every firm is a price taker. Then you also have a monopolist where there's just one firm controls the whole market. But then you have, according to standard mainstream theory, there's an intermediate case of what's called monopolistic competition where you have firms that have slightly differentiated products. So they do have some market power. They do have downward sloping demand curves, but yet they're not outright monopolists because they're in competition with each other. So here are the idea, like sneaker companies, for example, Nike and Adidas and Reebok. You might classify them as being in monopolistic competition, or cereal companies, you know, General Mills, and I forget who they're in competition with because I get, you know, various brands of cereals can all be owned by the same parent company, so I get them mixed up. But the cereal companies that are in competition with each other, they're similar type of thing where they certainly have brand name loyalty. There's some people that just want to eat Cheerios. But there's also a lot of spillover that if Cheerios get too expensive, some people will switch to eating whatever, shredded wheat or Rice Krispies or whatever. All right, so that's the idea. So the way this is taught, and you know, and I taught this when I was a college professor, and it's fun. You get out the colored chalk and you draw these cute diagrams and all this stuff. The way they do it is they say, okay, here's the average cost curve. So the idea is as quantity goes up, at first your average unit costs are dropping, but then they reach a minimum point here, and then as you increase output further, your unit costs start going up and up and up. Okay, so again, that's average cost. So what that means is total cost divided by the number of units. So on average, what are your costs of production per unit? And that's what that U-shaped thing is graphing. So under a perfectly competitive market condition where a firm is a price taker and faces this horizontal demand curve, look what happens. The idea is wherever that horizontal line happens to be originally, let's say originally it was up here like that. So I'm just sweeping out where it would be. Well, up there, the price would be above the average costs, and so firms would be making profits, right? The price per unit they would be earning would be higher than the cost per unit, so they're making that gap. So they're earning profits, so that would bring in more firms into the industry. So that would raise costs because, you know, I got more firms competing for the resources, and it would lower prices. And so the only long-run equilibrium in a competitive market is where there's this horizontal demand curve is just tangent to the average cost curve. Because if it were lower, if they weren't touching, if, you know, if the ACU there was totally above the price line, well, then that means no matter what the firm did, it would be losing money, right? Because average cost would be higher than the price. So firms would go out of business that would lower the cost, you know, that you would slide down and prices would go up, so that horizontal line would go up. And on the other hand, if the horizontal line were above that minimum point, then that means when the firm produced somewhere in the interior, its price per unit would be higher than the cost per unit. So they'd be earning positive economic profits, which would draw in more competitors, okay? So I'm just repeating the argument to show you, in long-run competitive equilibrium, using this kind of graphical analysis, a mainstream economist is going to say perfectly competitive firms produce at this point E, where the horizontal demand curve is just tangent to the average cost curve. So why is that interesting from a social welfare point of view? Oh, look it. The invisible hand leads perfectly competitive firms to set their output such that they produce where average costs are minimized. So that's kind of interesting. So, because remember, a firm in and of itself does not directly care about minimizing average unit cost. What a firm wants to do is maximize profits. And just depending on the way things are, a firm might not operate where it minimizes unit costs. So the next thing they do is they say, okay, now what if a firm is not a price taker? What if it's a monopolistically competitive firm? What if it's like Reebok? So they have some market power. Then they face a downward sloping demand curve. Now let's say it's originally this dotted line right here. So the point is if Reebok sets its quantity in this region somewhere so they can set the price on this part, then it's earning positive profits. But the idea is they can't do that forever. So that's one thing that distinguishes a monopolistically competitive industry from an actual monopoly. The monopoly can earn that monopoly price indefinitely. And, you know, what a mainstream economist would say is like the monopoly gain can just do that forever. Because outsiders can look at the De Beers monopoly on diamonds and say, gee, I guess, you know, it'd be great if we could get in that business, but they can't because they can't go buy it. They can't create a diamond mine. They just can't get at. Whereas if Reebok and Adidas and whatever, if they're earning positive profits, the idea is somebody else can come up with a rival shoe company and jump into the industry too. All right. So the idea is in long run equilibrium, what's going to happen is this downward sloping demand curve is going to move left, or the cost, the AC curve is going to shift up until there's a tangency, like at this solid line. And that's the long run stable point where the market price is equal to the average unit cost, so there's no incentive to firms to either come in or leave the industry. That's the idea. So okay, that's fine. What's the big deal? Oh, well, look at this, though. The tangency point here shows that the monopolistically competitive firm, led by the invisible hand, sets its output at a level where unit costs are not minimized. It's at this point here instead of down here. So, and that's true for every firm in this industry. So the mainstream economists who buy into this, they call that excess capacity. And the idea is you've got a bunch of sneaker companies, for example, that they have factories where they would be minimizing the cost per sneaker produced if they cranked out 100,000 units per year. but they actually don't maximize profit doing that. They only maximize profit cranking out 80,000 units per year. And so all these shoe companies have excess capacity. They're not running their operations at the point that would minimize cost per shoe. And so that's one of the arguments to demonstrate, allegedly, that outside of perfect competition, the invisible hand doesn't lead firms to do what's socially optimal. So Rofford brings up all sorts of objections to this. So one thing is, and here he's just repeating somebody, another economist, he said, wait a minute, you're telling me that the long-run stable equilibrium has all these shoe companies who built factories that are optimized when you produce 100,000 units, but instead they're perpetually only producing 80,000 units? Well, why are they so stupid? Why don't they, you know, when those factories become obsolete and they go to build new ones, why don't they build factories that are designed to only produce 80,000 per year? That's crazy. All right, so that's one observation. But another one that, well, there's two other ones, and I think Rofford made both of them up. So one thing is, he says, okay, wait a minute. They used this argument to show that they're trying to show that to go from this monopolistically competitive output to a perfectly competitive output would bring in more competitors, would increase production and lower prices. And then Rothbard's saying, well, I could just do the opposite. I could say that if you started out, or sorry, I said it the wrong way. He was saying that going from, hang on a second here, shift from monopoly to pure, yeah. So they were saying, I said the wrong one, they were saying going from pure competition to monopoly leads to a restriction in output and raising prices, and then here he tries to show the opposite, that if you started out from monopolistic competition and then you went to the purely competitive one, that it would you know, there'd initially be profits that would bring in more firms and so on. All right, I'm not doing it justice right here. I know I'm botching it. I'm getting a little bit mixed up. The point is, what he's trying to say there, and of course he's doing a better job than I am, is that one of the standard mainstream arguments, which I didn't give you right here, that's why I'm fumbling with it, is because he's riffing off of a different mainstream observation about this sort of analysis, is one of the ways they look at this diagram and then try to show that going from perfect competition to monopolistic competition is bad, it involves a train of argument that Rofford says, I could just do the opposite. I could start from monopolistic competition and go through to pure competition, and it would involve the same steps that the mainstreamers use going the other way. So if they think the other way proves monopolistic competition must be worse than where we started, I could just do the same thing going the other way. So therefore, it must be that monopolistic competition is better than pure competition. Okay, but again, I'm getting a little bit off on what the original mainstream argument was. The reason I can't remember is because it was a goofy argument. So it's hard for me to remember what they said that Rofford just flipped it on. Okay, but the one that I do remember better, and this is what I had in mind when I said this is one of my favorite arguments in the whole book, is Rofford, let's go back and review this. Rofford points out, he said, look, there's nothing about economics here. When they're getting this result that the monopolistically competitive firm necessarily produces it above the, or at a level where average costs are not minimized, you know, they produce up here rather than producing down here, that's just because of the way they drew these curves. That's because they like to draw nice smooth curves. So yeah, if you have a smooth AC curve, and then you're going to draw two lines that are tangent to it, and one line's horizontal and the other one's downward sloping, Yeah, it's necessarily going to be the case that the downward sloping one's going to be tangent in a point above this point there. But what if the AC curve isn't smooth, which, of course, in the real world, there's no reason to expect that it would be. What if it looks like this? Well, then I can have a downward sloping demand curve that intersects the AC curve at its minimum point. So it's not true that, in general, firms that face downward sloping demand curves are going to have to produce, if you want to produce at a point where price equals average cost, so there's no economic profits being earned, there's no reason that has to occur at a place above the minimum of average cost. But that's solely a result of the fact that mainstream economists like to use nice smooth curves to make pretty pictures. So anyway, that's a brilliant insight that I think only somebody like Rothbard would be able to come up with, because in mainstream economics, you just get in the habit of drawing the nice smooth curves thinking that, oh, well, we're just doing this for convenience, but in practice, they derive some conclusions from it that they don't realize are utterly dependent on those assumptions that were just supposed to be there for convenience. Okay, so, oh, is there one? All right, we're kind of out of time here. I don't want to get into the patent versus copyright because that would take too long. So I will, I'll talk about this at the start of next week's lecture because it is an interesting issue, but I won't have time to do it justice. So let me see right now in the meantime if there's any quick questions I can answer. Just 1 second, pulling up, okay. Okay, Balasubramanian says, isn't Rothbard saying that the sale of a stock already produced is costless? Does that not mean that bringing total cost into the discussion is not a proper counter to what he said? Just referring to the point made in the session regarding how a mainstream neoclassical economist would respond to Rothbard's point about monopoly price and elasticity of demand. Okay, that's a good point. All right, so what Balasubramanian, sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, is getting at, let me just make sure everyone's got that. It's a good point. So remember, Rothbard, following Mises, said that when it comes to the analysis of monopolies, the only time it's even an issue, even if you do have a single seller, is if the previous prevailing competitive price happened to be in an inelastic region, because then the monopolist raises total revenues by restricting output. But now the question is, and so then I said, but a mainstream economist wouldn't buy that because there's also the cost side, that what the producer wants to do is maximize profit, not maximize total revenue. And so it might make sense, it would make sense, at least in the mainstream analysis, to restrict output even if total revenue goes down, because total cost would go down more. So the question then is, well, wait a minute, but if Rothbard thinks that costs are basically virtually zero once the stock is produced, then doesn't that objection fall away? Yeah, I guess if you're talking about a one-shot analysis of a producer who has an existing stock of goods and is trying to decide what to do with them. But typically I think we have in mind somebody who's in business over a period of time and is going to keep producing and then selling. And so there, even Rothbard would incorporate what the mainstream economist means by the cost of production. Right? So Rothbard wouldn't do it the same way exactly, but it's still not true. I don't think that a producer, because what Rothbard is really saying is that the producer is not going to set output to maximize total revenue, and that's not true. I mean, you could reduce output and lower revenue as long as you lowered your monetary cost of production or monetary expenses. So you are right if you're talking about a one-shot short-term analysis where the stuff's already produced and what are we going to do with it. But if we're thinking about a more long-term thing where there's going to be production involved, I think it's still not quite right just to focus on the revenue side. Okay, why don't we do, I think there's one, there was a long question, but it wasn't really relevant to this week's material, so I won't deal with that now. Okay, last one for tonight. Jeffrey Ludwig says, regarding modern monopoly analysis, did Mises even consider it a restriction of production to base production off of where the marginal revenue curve rather than where the average revenue curve crosses the marginal cost curve? In other words, did he not take into account the supposed deadweight loss along an elastic demand curve? Because a situation where no deadweight loss would occur is an unrealizable utopia. Therefore, there would simply be different degrees of deadweight losses, which would simply be the result of how producers construct the supply curve. Then, if this is correct, would it be safe to say that Rothbard came in and corrected Mises regarding the condition of an inelasticity of demand for establishing a monopoly price? You know, Jeff, I'm not really getting what you're saying. So let me, if you want to come back and clarify it, then I'll try to do it. But for right now, let me just say, I don't think we should read too deeply into it. I'm getting the sense that all Mises and Rothbard are looking at is that they were looking and saying, if it's an inelastic demand curve at the competitive level, and now all of a sudden somebody has the ability to control the whole industry, well then, duh, of course you would restrict output. Because then the price goes up by more than your quantity goes down, so total revenue goes up. And then we're just very quickly thinking, oh, but if it were elastic, you wouldn't do that because if you restrict output, then your revenues go down. And so you wouldn't, and I don't think that, I mean, I know this sounds bold to say that they just made a mistake, but I mean, I think they kind of did. They just, the context of reading them and whatever, it seems to me like they're just overlooking the fact that just because a change makes your total revenue go down, that by itself doesn't prove that it's a bad business decision. That you also need to check, does it make your costs go down by more than your revenue? Now, it's true, like the last question brought up, mainstream economists are a lot more objective with their notion of cost than the Austrians are, so maybe there's some subtlety going on there, but even so, I mean, we can imagine real-world cases of a firm cutting back production in order to, you know, to think that that's the best thing to do for the business. And that, and even while total revenues go down. So yeah, cost is subjective and we can, you know, worry about all that stuff, but surely it's not right to imply that all a business wants to do, or that a business would never do something that would lower total revenue. I don't think that that's right. And so, yeah, it's possible there's something real subtle going on that I'm missing, but I read Human Action several times, obviously, so I've seen the parts where Mises talks about that, and I never got the sense from him that he was analyzing that subtlety and then dismissing it for some reason. I just don't think he ever really took it that far. But you know, maybe I'm wrong. I hope I am wrong, because it's kind of awkward for me to be saying Mises and Rockford kind of missed what seems to be a basic point. On the other hand, I mean, it's, again, remember, I'm talking about monopoly theory the way I learned it 10 years ago. It's possible that mainstream people talked that way back in 1940, and that's what Mises was responding to in Human Action, and then Rothbard just picked it up when he was writing Man, Economy, and State. So, you know, there's that issue, too, that it's possible mainstream analysis evolved, and it really was that crude back when Mises and Rothbard were hammering it, and now it's a lot more sophisticated. So that's another explanation, too, that maybe they were accurately talking about mainstream monopoly theory at the time. Okay, well, let me stop there, and I will talk to, or see you guys next week, and I'll send out an email blast tomorrow about when the office hours will be and so forth. Okay, thanks, everybody.